Why, we're from the birds sing a pretty song. And there's always music in the air.
Diane, it's 8:17 p.m.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Twin Peaks Peaks. My name is Ashley Brandt.
My name is Matthew Olson. Hello. We're here to talk about part 13 of Twin Peaks The Return, an episode where some stuff happens, and there's a really unexpected turn at the end. And I'm still processing it.
Yeah, this is maybe one of the more productive episodes, I want to say. Productive is maybe not the right word, but there's a lot of movement. And there's also a lot of, like, ambient shots of some of our favorite old cast members just doing stuff.
It doesn't feel totally plotty, but stuff does undeniably happen in this episode for good and for cringe. I don't know. It gets off to a really strong start in Las Vegas, in my mind, with the conga line through the Lucky Seven insurance building, which was just a delight to see. And the Dougie Cooper good fortune string continues, basically. I was thinking about Anthony cowering behind the desk as a moment that felt so much like the old show to me. For some reason, that, like, behavior struck me as, like, this is, like, the weirdness that Twin Peaks, like, was good at doing, and that, like, fans of the old show really loved, including that moment for me.
That's really interesting that you say that, because I think the conga line reminded me a lot of Mulholland Drive.
Particularly which part of Mulholland Drive, like, or which plot thread, you'd say?
Not like a plot thread, but like the feel of Mulholland Drive and like the elements of kind of show business absurdism throughout Mulholland Drive.
Mm. Yeah, I can see it kind of being of a flavor with, I mean, just whenever I see Mandy, Candy, and Sandy in the cocktail dresses, I, like, get that pang of the audition scene in Mulholland Drive with the girls trying the different songs. But if Las Vegas is our Mulholland Drive touchstone, I mean, we get some good Patrick Fischler in this episode too, like right after this scene. Yeah, I mean, not much to remark on Bushnell other than, like, well, now he's got a matching BMW with Dougie. You left a note in our notes, though, particularly about when this scene occurs. Do you want to explain your concern about that vis-a-vis Dougie's appearance last episode?
Yeah, because Janie and Bushnell both seem to imply that Dougie's been MIA for about 2 days, but we did get that delightful Dougie scene in the last episode where he was seen throwing around a ball with Sonny Jim, or, like, more accurately, the ball was being thrown at him, which implies that he had, would imply in that timeline that he had been home. I think they just had a great piece of footage and they didn't know where to put it, but the show's, like, pretty deliberate about laying out timelines and clues and showing you where characters are, because time is not actually moving very quickly. Not a lot of time really has passed since we picked up with The Return. So to have that timeline discrepancy feels a little odd.
I'm in agreement with regards to if you have the great footage of Kyle getting beaned and you don't know where to slot it in and you happen to cut an episode where he wouldn't be in it otherwise, you might as well use it. Like, I don't know if we remarked strongly enough about how last episode that was Kyle's only scene. I would opt for that. And we did talk about Diane's wardrobe and how people were speculating whether or not that was presented out of order because of the wardrobe. But I don't know. I think I just take this as like, yeah, exactly that. You had this clip of Dougie that could have taken place before he went to his meeting with the Mitchums. And now we're just seeing the aftermath of, you know, their night out, their dinner together. And Dougie's going to eat some more pie.
Yeah. Well, and it certainly doesn't take place or wasn't intended to take place after the events of this episode, because after the events of this episode, their backyard has a brand new playset for Sonny Jim that's taking up a lot of real estate.
Yeah, that was maybe the most, I wouldn't say characteristically David thing, but the addition of the spotlight alone, if it had just been the gym set with the rotating spotlight, that would have been one thing. But then how the arch and everything being like
the
just
music
draped in lights. Yeah. It reminded me somewhat of, I don't think David had a hand in this scene at all, of the scene in season 2 where Ben and Jerry reminisce about the girl doing the flashlight dance in their room as they were growing up.
But
just like this innocence tinged with, like, I'm sure David thinks that's the perfect, you know, version of a gym set draped in lights with a creepy spotlight.
Well,
but
also,
you wouldn't be able to explain to him how it's not, how it's kind of strange.
Yeah, well, the arc of lights or whatever and the music reminded me of Vegas showmanship and maybe the idea that the Mitchums just had shit like this, or this is what their normal was. Because it looks a little like the Las Vegas Strip, you know?
It does, yeah. I mean, I could see that, because think about it, you put Mandy, Candy, Sandy there, suddenly it's actually a more complete, sensible picture.
Yeah.
You could imagine a Mitchum-owned like gym set for adults that's draped in lights and has cocktail girls walking around.
Yeah. Looking back, the picture of Sonny Jim furiously playing by himself on that playset, like the speed with which he's just running through that is very uncanny valley, very David.
Yeah, it's a perfect moment as far as I'm concerned. But that's not to say that there isn't some frustrating stuff in Vegas this week. Namely, hey, the Fuscos aren't going to do shit.
Thanks,
which is
David
characteristic,
Koechner.
But...
You know what I figured out I know David Koechner from?
What?
Another Period.
I don't know what that is.
That's Natasha Leggero's show on Comedy Central.
Okay.
He is one of the main cast members there.
Okay. I mean, I just can't get the Anchorman association out of my head whenever I see him.
As soon as you say that, I see him in Anchorman, but I never watched Anchorman repeatedly or anything like that, so.
Well, just remember, he's the one who's not Paul Rudd or Steve Carell. That's him.
I can't even picture Paul Rudd in that movie, so that tells you how many times I've seen Anchorman.
Paul has the long wig with the mustache in that movie.
It's been more than 10 years since I've seen Anchorman.
Since we're already off on a tangent, I'm just going to say this here. Speaking of Paul Rudd, have you watched the new Wet Hot American Summer yet? Because your fave, Chris Pine, is pretty great in it.
Yeah. I think that was a great career move.
Yeah. I was thinking while I was watching, I was like, man, wouldn't have been sick if Chris Pine had turned up on Twin Peaks.
He could have just been the best career move.
He could have played a logger. He could have like taken Balthazar Getty's role.
Yes.
He could have competed with Bobby, our boy.
See.
We should cast this show.
If there was going to be a season 2, I would want Chris Pine to be in it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so the Fuscos, I mean, I love how this is recognizing the ridiculousness of the Dougie situation, but from the exact wrong angle. Like, again, like, Cooper is in a sense getting lucky because he's not getting, you know, brought in on the charges that his doppelganger has amassed. But also it's just like, oh, they recognize that something's weird here, but they think it was just like a clerical fuck up, and then they're gonna like play basketball with trash. Like, I like those three characters, but it was frustrating because that's the most in like the last couple installments I felt like there was any chance of like a Cooper recognition being dangled in Vegas. And then it was immediately tossed away, and that was a little annoying.
Yeah, I definitely thought that that's where that was going. But if we see the Fuscos again, I hope it's at Sunday dinner.
Admiring Dougie's new BMW, wondering like, where'd he get that?
Well, must I want to see money. Their Sunday dinner that they've been invited to by their mother.
Oh, sorry. I must have, I watched this episode once through, and then second time I had it on the background, I must have missed that dialogue. Aren't they talking about their mother hoping that there are no more murders, and then they just like start guffawing?
No, they're making a joke between themselves. They're like, wouldn't that be nice? Hopefully there are no murders so we can go to Sunday dinner with our mother.
Who do you think would play their mother?
Wow. Great question. Weirdly, like, I want it to be Katie Sagal.
Okay.
Or Kathy Bates. Two directions.
Kathy Bates would be good, I think. If the Fuscos were related to another family in Twin Peaks, who would they be related to? Who would they be the cousins of?
Brennans.
The Brennans. It's just like the different flavors of like incompetent cop.
Yeah. And that's how we get to Twin Peaks from Las Vegas. Mm-hmm, is mm-hmm. Andy and Lucy are at Sunday dinner. It's a special occasion.
I don't
know if Cooper comes up. Because as we've seen, nobody's really connecting those dots and those storylines, but I think that's how we do it.
Yeah. I really wonder if, because I feel like, and there are people getting anxious now, being like, there's 5 episodes left. We're not going to resolve anything at this rate. I can't believe it's still dug in. It's like, come on. You must have known this is coming at this point. But I still believe that we're going to end up with Cooper in whatever state conveyed to Twin Peaks at some point. I'm just wondering what that's gonna be like. Is that actually gonna be through intervention on, you know, on the behalf of other people? I mean, Gordon and Albert have a plan, certainly, so they can scoop in and pick him up if they figure it out. But I don't know where I'm leaning. Do you have any particular predictions in mind? Other than Sunday dinner, of course.
Other than Sunday dinner, which is my first choice, I'm going to have to say...
Do you think Cooper arrives in Twin Peaks of his own volition?
No. And that's what I would have suspected initially. I think that David has written the role of Gordon Cole for himself such that Gordon and Albert are gonna swoop into Las Vegas.
I would also really like to see, you know, a scene with Miguel and David and Naomi. Like, that would be great.
That'd be delightful.
I'd love to see Miguel patiently explaining to I'd love to see Albert explaining to Janie E, like, he's not actually your husband. He looks a lot like your husband, but he's not.
Well, or that your husband was created by Doppelgoop some years ago.
Yeah, your husband was a golden orb.
Created out of ether by a force of evil.
Yeah. They induct Janie E into the Blue Rose. They tell her all this classified stuff. No Gordon and Albert this week, actually. No Buckhorn action,
no
really.
Diane. And I was going to say, did you see that Laura Dern is running for Academy President? Like, Academy President of the Academy Awards?
No, I did not see that.
Yeah, no, okay. It's very, very exciting news.
Is David going to sit out, like, on, what was it, like, on Hollywood Boulevard with a cow again to be like, yes, elect Laura Dern as president.
I hope so.
It'd be great. Maybe it'll be two cows this time. Yeah. For your consideration, Laura Dern, Academy president. So yeah, none of the Buckhorn crew. In fact, the people we check in with who we've associated with Buckhorn are now firmly out. They're on the road or in Montana, as is the case with Mr. C.
You're talking about Chantal and Tim Roth, right?
Yeah, they're passing through to Utah.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say they are in Utah. I think they're on their way to Las Vegas, because that's
how that's their next stop. Yeah,
geography works.
That's how geography works. I put two and two together with that scene. And I saw a couple takes being like, that scene was pointless. Like, why did we check in with those characters? You could have left that out. And it's like, I really liked that scene.
Hey, they got their Wendy's.
They got their
very
Wendy's.
Very important.
Chantal was chowing down. And they had a great discussion about polygamy.
Jennifer Jason Leigh and Tim Roth, you gotta use them.
I like these two characters who are just weird swinger assassins who like junk food and have like speculative pulling things out of their ass, talking about things that they've heard, you know, road trip conversations like, oh yeah, yeah. Utah, Mormons, right? What do Mormons do? And it's a character beat that I appreciate, despite thinking that these two characters in the grand scheme of things are not important. Like they're gonna make an attempt on Dougie's life, and then they'll probably like be jailed like Ike the Spike.
Yeah, I think they could definitely be a false lead, but at this point they're the only characters that are moving from one plot to another.
Not true.
By virtue of moving from one location to another, who are you thinking of?
Richard. Richard pops up.
That is correct.
In Montana this episode, which is something that I feel like did not get enough play in people's reactions. It's like, oh, this is finally where the first two of these like separated plot lines have crossed over on the physical material plane.
That's very true.
We should talk about the fucking farm and the arm wrestling. Is this David Lynch's version of Over the Top?
How so? That's just not a word that came to mind, so I'm curious as to why you chose that.
No, Over the Top, the movie.
Oh, well, I don't know that movie, so here we are.
Okay, it's a movie starring Sylvester Stallone as a trucker, and he goes to Las Vegas to arm wrestle in like an arm wrestling competition. And yeah, it's a whole fucking movie about arm wrestling.
I mean, I believe you.
Of course, it's like presented much more conventionally than like this version of an arm wrestling scene is.
Yeah.
I mean, I had no idea where this was going to go. I was immediately like, in terms of like little touches, the giant display that's inexplicably in the farm that everybody's watching things happen on was a great thing to like let you know, like, yes, this is a den of criminals, but it's not like what you might think. Otherwise, it appears to be a totally empty warehouse. I mean, kudos to all those extras, all the tough guy extras, and then the one nerdy accountant dude.
The accountant!
Yeah, this was full of great little touches, but the absurdity of it all resolving this arm wrestling thing was totally paid off by like how the doppelganger actually reacts and follows through with it, I think. Do you think we should read a lot more into the starting position line?
Yes.
In terms of like this being a return to Twin Peaks.
Yep, yeah. 100%. There are a lot of very loaded lines of dialogue in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
IMO. This scene also really brought home the importance of Philip Jeffries, who we haven't seen, who we may not see, but Philip Jeffries took out a hit on Mr. C.
Yeah, or someone claiming to be Philip.
Or, that's the other option. Yeah. And Doppelcoop now has Philip Jeffries' supposed location. So this, I mean, I'm taking this as like, this is his new direction, is to find the Dutchmans and Philip Jeffries.
Yeah, we haven't heard the Dutchmans mentioned before, correct?
No, I rewound it because I thought it was going to be Jackrabbit's Palace.
No. Nope. So wherever this location is, who knows? We still haven't checked back in with where the fuck that box in Buenos Aires is. Really, at this point, I mean, if we're following this timeline and this isn't happening, like, you know, a day ago, then Cooper's doppelganger doesn't have much more time to get to Twin Peaks before at least the 1st of October, if not the 2nd, because there are two dates and 2:53 p.m. listed on Briggs's piece of paper. So there could be, you know, could be an opening and a closing, or, you know, something like that with regards to whatever's at Jackrabbit's Palace, be that the entrance to the lodges or whatever. Philip, it's difficult. It's difficult to know where they're taking this, because we don't know that much about Philip. Like, leave aside, like, the David Bowie, like, filming circumstances aside, like, we still haven't learned that much in the intervening parts, like, what Philip's angle could be here, other than wanting Bob, potentially. But that's it. To what end, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, Albert established that Philip Jeffries kind of reported to David and reported.
Oops. You made the opposite mistake.
Philip Jeffries reported to Gordon and recruited people for the Blue Rose Project. And it seems like the fact that he took a hit out on Mr. C, to me, that definitively indicates, until proven otherwise, that he is a benevolent force in the world of Twin Peaks in terms of working against the Lodge. And it seems like he's maybe the only person who's put some significant details together.
Yeah, possibly. But, like, the last time we saw him, if we're counting the missing pieces, which I think we should, he got zapped back to... was that Buenos Aires in Missing Pieces? Yeah, he got zapped back to the hotel, and the bellboy was like, Mr. Jeffries, the shit is in my pants. Like, there's so much for him to have put together that we don't know.
But if he's the head of Blue Rose under Gordon...
Was that implied?
He was, yeah.
I thought they just named... agents. I didn't think they named a hierarchy, but I could be mistaken.
No. Well, Albert said that Philip Jeffries was recruited first, and then that he in turn recruited the others. So I take that as a kind of like he was bestowed that power by Gordon situation.
But if that's
not that he was just like outsourcing his labor.
Right. If that's all it'd take to be. I mean, again, though, we just saw a couple parts back, you know, Gordon and Albert walk up to a fucking swirling portal and treat it was like it was no big deal. So they're clearly working with more information than we know. So as for how much they actually understood about the lodges and all this stuff, you know, back in 1989, you know, who knows?
I mean, obviously, we won't know until we see or hear more of Philip Jeffries, but he's also been in the field for 25 years, so...
He's been somewhere for 25 years. Somewhere. Indeterminate. Maybe above a convenience store, who knows. Briggs gets mentioned. The doppelganger brings up Briggs. Do you think that what we're building towards is a... cooperation between Jeffries and Briggs? Is that what starts to make sense in your mind in terms of trying to pick up these pieces?
Yeah, definitely.
I wonder if they're working from different ends, because to me everything so far seems to have suggested that Briggs went into hiding after seeing the doppelganger, and I won't, like, how would that work if Jeffries wasn't interacting with him? I don't know.
Wait, so you think that Briggs faked his own death?
He definitely faked his own death at the lookout station, and then somehow he ended up in the zone where 25 years later he was encountered by Bill Hastings and Ruth Davenport, and he hadn't aged much. So he wasn't, like, out and about for a significant period of time after he faked his own death.
Am I missing something? Because I just interpreted that to be a supernatural, potentially doppelganger situation.
What do you mean? Like, it was Briggs's doppelganger who they encountered?
Yeah.
But then why is Briggs's body turning up the next day?
Because that's the doppelganger's body.
So you're saying they should check the double check those fingerprints, make sure that one's not transposed.
Yeah.
I think it's the real Briggs.
Do you think he faked his own death and went into hiding, or do you think he was like sucked from this reality into some kind of stasis where he didn't age?
I mean, it could have been both. Like, it could have been him trying to enact his next plan in order to maybe rescue Coop, and then it went wrong, and he ended up stuck in a place for close to 25 years as well. You know, it could be that. But I'm also wondering if we're actually going to get much explanation as to what Philip and Major Briggs were up to.
You know what? Probably not.
I don't want to gloss over, though, here the... the amazing work Kyle puts in. Like, this is the longest we spent. I mean, we haven't seen the doppelganger in a couple episodes, but during the arm wrestling match and at points during Ray's interrogation, he's like genuinely menacing, and it's striking to see that versus his, like, you know, toddler like gentle demeanor as Dougie. Like, this episode for me, of all of them that have featured both, really brought home the gulf between those two performances and how well Kyle traverses those.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting because Dougie is such a passive force. Things just kind of act upon him, and I wouldn't even necessarily say that he reacts. He's kind of an object in his own life, being manipulated by...
By dandruff.
Yeah, who could blame him? But at the same time, Mr. C is really defining... He's enacting so much change upon his environment and dominating his environment. It's a very stark contrast, and I think it is interesting in juxtaposition to some of the existential and potentially like metatextual gestures that are included in this episode.
I think I know what scene you're talking about. Yeah. I think the roles that these two are playing, like, I keep seeing people like anticipating a meeting between the doppelganger and Good Cooper, like a showdown. And I just don't think this show is interested in that kind of thing in terms of like the like good versus evil triumph, even if it was like just like a chase sequence through like the Red Room or something. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. I'm still wondering if we're going to see any of Cooper as we know him kind of return to us in time for like such a showdown versus like putting that power and dominance of the doppelganger character like up against other characters who we care about. Or, you know, I think that might be a more interesting situation, both dramatically and like in terms of the pieces on the board that we have right now. Like, the direction this show has been going, like, everybody in Twin Peaks with the sheriff's department is like working towards this goal, and if it turns out that then Cooper arrives like with his full faculties and is there to like have his like showdown, like, that's kind of weird. Like, it would rob some of the movement that those characters have been having. Not saying that I want to see Bobby go up against the doppelganger, because I don't think Bobby would win, but just saying, I'm not optimistic. But Ray got a shot on him, so I don't know.
Yeah, well,
Bobby's killed two men, so at least two.
This is true. And Ray's in the lodge now, and Mike has the ring, most importantly.
Yeah, this clears up that it seems that what they're gesturing towards is definitely like, if you have the ring on and die, the ring both gets teleported back to the lodge, and somehow your essence is teleported to the lodge.
Right. I think it's important to note, because we've been talking about Philip Jeffries, that Ray is given the instructions by Philip Jeffries or someone impersonating Philip Jeffries to kill Mr. C and put the ring on Mr. C.
Yeah.
So someone, Phil Jeffries or whoever, has figured that out. That's a huge lodge thing.
Yeah. Which, again, kind of robs the ring of some of its mystery, but it's fine. I mean, I assume that if Ray had left it on and just wore it like it was a normal ring, eventually his arm would have gone numb and other stuff, but...
Yeah. But Mike having the ring is a big thing.
having it, and also somehow, because remember, he, if we're assuming there's one ring, right, then somehow it needed to leave the lodge after Dougie was sucked in order to make it to Ray in the first place. So if there's one ring and it like has to travel around like that, there was some kind of exchange there, or, you know, some way of getting it to Buckhorn, or I guess the prison in this case. I'm starting to trip over all this lodge stuff, and I feel like it's just like, we got to wait and see. We did gloss over Tom Sizemore, I realized, who does a lot of good crying this episode.
He does some good crying. I mean, he's really been touched by Dougie's supernatural goodness.
I mean, he got touched by Dougie on the dandruff. And but then just cracked.
He's going to roll on all of the dirty cops in Vegas and Mr. Todd.
Yeah, yeah.
Bushnell is just a stern dad who's glad that he messed up to his wrongdoing.
Bushnell is a pure trusting soul when it comes down to it. So long as you tell him you did a wrong, he's all right.
And Tom Sizemore is so touched by the goodness of Dougie.
Mm-hmm. Some real class act, grown man blubbering. There was another detail I want to make sure we didn't miss there, though, with Tom and Dougie and the attempt on his life. But now, for the life of me, I can't remember. Oh, no, it was the fact that this whole thing is a fucking Breaking Bad pastiche. This, like, the sequence with the poisoning the coffee
of course.
I mean, and I feel comfortable saying that, given that it's one of the few things that David has gone on record saying he liked watching. Like, you put the poison in the coffee. What was the last show?
Yeah.
Another thing on that note, when Anthony goes and dumps the coffee in the urinal, I was convinced that the guy who's like, that bad, huh? I was convinced from the back that was Mark Frost. But the person who plays Man in Urinal, if I'm not mistaken, is just credited as Malone. One name. I should Google, is Mark Frost's nickname Malone? Just see what Mark Frost's nickname picks up. Well, the first thing that picks up is a darts player named Mark Frost, who had a nickname, Frosty the Throw Man. But,
that's too good.
So that, I'm glad I Googled that, but it wasn't Mark Frost's, our Mark Frost nickname. Anyway, let's move on. I think that covers Montana and other parts. So we can talk about good old Twin Peaks, the town itself.
There's a lot happening in terms of kind of the breadth of things that we are treated to in the town of Twin Peaks, although there's only really one venue where there's some kind of tangible semblance of plot movement, which I'm not maligning by any means, but it feels like there's a lot, and then you remember, oh, those are a lot of one-off scenes.
Well, it's a lot of like little character plots, because as much as I would like for Nadine and Norma and James Hurley to play a big role in the finale, they're not. And we see Bobby, but Bobby, again, complicating our timeline of things, says that this is the same day that he discovered the contents of the cylinder at his mother's house, which doesn't quite track, because we saw him in the diner at night since then. So is this implying that's the same night? I don't really care. If the timeline's a little fuzzy on that, I don't really mind. I could definitely believe, well, I couldn't believe the Double R reopening right after the gunshot, but I don't know. Maybe this was a night before that night, and the timeline doesn't really like care either way, because this is the episode where they've got to talk about Big Ed.
This is also the scene that we saw filmed.
It is. Yeah. So we might as well start here and then jump around to the other scenes kind of in a different order. So way back in September of 2015, when we both lived in Portland, when I think one of us was employed full time.
That was me.
we went to North Bend, and the night that we went there and saw them film, they were filming in the double R, and it was this scene. And I don't think we realized that Norma was in the scene, because we couldn't really see that corner of the diner.
Okay, because we could see Silver Fox, Dana Ashbrook in that beautiful denim ensemble. Not denim. Mm-hmm. Beautiful flannel is what I meant. I remember seeing him, like, jump up and down and, like, shake it out a little bit before entering the diner. Mm-hmm. We could see the silhouette of Everett McGill.
Yep.
And we could see a mysterious, unknown third person enter with a briefcase.
Yep. And, of course, that person turns out to be Walter, as played by Grant Goodeve, who you may have seen in many things. If you've ever played the video game Team Fortress 2, he's the engineer in that, which so it's probably his best-known role. But he was also in Northern Exposure, which is a show that was also filmed in rural Washington. It premiered in 1990, so a year, or the same year as Twin Peaks, I guess. Yeah, was it 90 or 89? We weren't born then. It doesn't matter to me.
It's set in 89, but it premiered in 90.
Anyway, Grant Goodeve was a character on that show, and not when that show started, because it was set in Alaska, and it was like big city doctor goes to like the small town, and that was way more the focus. But then they realized that they wrote a really shitty big city doctor character who nobody liked, I'm pretty sure. So the subsequent seasons focused on the weird, quirky townsfolk, and people were just like, oh, this is just like Twin Peaks without the mystery. So it's strange to see him pop up here. He also hosted, I remember this distinctly, he hosted like a local interest show in the Seattle area as I grew up, like on our local NBC affiliate. There was just like touring Washington with Grant Goodeve, and he would just like, I'm gonna take this plane and fly out to a vineyard, look at what rich white people out here enjoy doing. So Grant Goodeve, Walter, and Walter is a capitalist scumbag.
That he is, because he wants to harm the integrity of Norma's brand for the sake of her, of the bottom line of the franchises of Norma's Double R Diner.
I would say he wants to harm the integrity of Norma's soul for this franchise, because Norma doesn't see it as a brand. Norma puts love in her pies, or at least all natural organic
love
ingredients
and local natural organic ingredients.
I will say, when she said that, I was like, well, now you're just making the pies sound like hippy dippy and like
health
food.
That was also what I was thinking.
But it is, I was more affected by this revelation that the Double R has been franchised and that the quality is not up to snuff at these other locations. Like, I was like, that's a real bummer.
Because when we were in North Bend, we thought it was a big deal that we could see a sign that said, like, Double R to go. We were like, that's the big change. Updating the Double R to the 21st century is the to-go option.
Mm-hmm. And we'll also see in the same episode that the to-go option is really sad. But I guess jumping around a bit, it is time for the long-awaited return of a very special segment of Twin Peaks Peaks that newer listeners who've joined us for the return won't be as familiar with. But I promise it's a good one. It is time, dear listeners, for Drape Runner Corner. Now, as we've just discussed, Norma has found a new man in Walter, and in one way, I'm happy for Norma. I'm sad. I don't have anything against Norma. I wish her the best in terms of her business and her personal love life and aspirations, and I hope that damn good pie doesn't change one iota. But also, that means that she has backed off from Big Ed, which means that my OTP, given just this scene, should be safe. We see Big Ed, he has his wedding ring on, and that means if he's not with Norma, clearly he must be with Nadine. But it's not so simple, because we also link up with Nadine this episode, and we see Nadine flirting openly with Dr. Jacoby. that gold shovel slinging home wrecker. And I say to Dr. Jacoby, drop the act, cancel the show, vacate the airwaves, and get your damn shovels out of Nadine's store. I'll have none of this. It's Ed and Nadine all the way. For me, Matt Olson, co-host of this show, who will always stand by this pairing and always have this segment when appropriate. Ashley, how do you feel about the bastard Jacoby entering the storyline this way?
I think that they're star-crossed lovers. I'm pair those two off. Give them a spin-off. I'm ready.
I would rather see Nadine end up with Mike. How dare you?
Maybe she will.
Jacoby is a bad man. One, we already knew he was married. Two, he like pined for Laura Palmer.
That man does not have his license to practice psychiatry for a reason.
Yeah. Well, we'll revisit Big Ed in a bit here, but we should note that we did get a nice scene between Shelley and Becky, and every scene with Amanda Seyfried is like a joy, because I was really wondering if after her first appearance that was going to be all we got, if it was going to be like a small vignette. But no, I'm glad that it seems like we're going to see some kind of resolution for the Becky storyline. I hopefully that'll build towards something positive, or just like something. I want Becky to get out of that relationship.
No, absolutely. And that would be really cathartic. At the end of this episode, we should round up every plot line that can or could be resolved.
Oh boy. Okay.
By the end of season two.
We'll do that. At season three. And we'll do that. We'll do that in lieu of the other segment that I've pioneered that people clearly miss, the coffee pie log rating. We'll do the plot lines.
Thank you. That's a great scene though. And there's
Shelley being a great mom. Well, as good of a mom as she can be over the phone and not really able to help with this situation.
I loved the dramatic acting that Amanda Seyfried was serving us as she contemplated the deliciousness of the pies and the offer of hanging out with her mom, who is an angel on this earth.
Yeah, even though I'm disappointed that Shelley is with Red, still, Shelley's trying to be there for Becky, and I really appreciated that scene. We should check in with our Palmer about town this week, holed up in her house and watching the same 10 seconds of a boxing match over and over again as she struggles to make herself yet another Bloody Mary. This scene was the most uncomfortable for me because it was both very sad and I was on edge the whole time wondering if that crackle sound that plays every time the boxing match loops was going to like lead to like a woodsman jumping out or something. But no, it's just another sit and wait scene as you watch Grace Zabriskie kind of inhabit this hovel, this like dark existence that Sarah has carved out for herself. And it's really a bummer.
I love that scene. I love the staging. I love that you can very clearly see it's the Palmer living room that's now dominated by this huge TV that's only used to play really violent animal documentaries and old boxing matches looping, and the beautiful coffee table is just covered in alcohol bottles, and you can tell it smells like cigarettes.
We got our Laura Flynn Boyle cameo of the show, in that there is visible a picture frame of Laura and Donna on the table. So Donna, for those who are wondering if this is like an alternate timeline or something, Donna exists, and that's all we're gonna say about Donna.
Can we talk about my great fear when I was looking at the credits for this episode?
Yeah, but I feel like we should save that for when we are talking about that scene in earnest.
Okay, fine.
We'll get there. We've got to talk about that scene, but
I mean, we have two scenes left to talk about, and one is a little meatier than the other.
I feel like we should save the Roadhouse performance and then the credit scene for the end. For the, those should be the last two things we talk about.
Okay, sure.
So, do you think that that's Battling Bud she's watching, perchance?
I have no idea.
It'd be cool. I was hoping that they would announce that, and then I was like, trained my ear to listen closely for maybe like they say Bud, and then instead it was just like, why is this shit looping? Like, what? And I also don't buy the idea that that's a sign of like time being weird in Twin Peaks.
No, that woman just wants to have the TV on because she lives alone and her entire family is dead. And she doesn't care if it's looping. She's not going to get up and change the channel. She's not that motivated. She's just very sad and she wants some sound in her house.
Exactly. Yeah. I feel like everyone getting hung up on like what it means, the same 10 seconds of looping, are losing the part where like it means Sarah is in the dumps. Like, are you paying attention to what she's actually doing? Like looking for the last drops of vodka in these bottles. It's brutal. I just wonder if those teens ever actually, like, are those teens ever going to actually deliver her bottles? Is this the last of what she has? Does she have to go back to the grocery store now?
No, I thought these were the new bottles. Because I don't think Sarah Palmer is in a place where she buys ahead of time. I think she runs out. Mm-hmm. I think she goes to the grocery store. I think maybe her what happened at the grocery store has a little something to do with alcohol detox.
Yeah.
These are my thoughts.
Yeah, I could very much see that, especially if we're thinking of like, I think this is an appropriate thread to like theorize down, like the alcohol as a way to like dampen like the psychic, like, like Sarah gets like inhabited and like has these like visions and stuff, and if that's a way to turn it off, then you know, still a bummer, but makes sense. And gosh, just like I loved having Grace at the store and in that scene with Hawk. Like, I want more Sarah Palmer interacting with the townsfolk.
Yeah. Maybe she could go to the diner and link up with sad divorced dad, Bobby Briggs, and sad, I don't know if he's divorced, Ed Hurley.
Yeah, just join the sad trio. It'd be something.
A little support group, but no one's as sad as Sarah, so I understand why she's withdrawn from the world.
Yeah.
There's no support group for your husband molested your daughter and now they're both dead.
No. Audrey's pretty sad, though. Though I don't even know if Audrey's in this world at this point. I don't know if there'd be any chance for her to link up with anybody to commiserate with, because I have no fucking clue what's up with Audrey after this like week's scene.
Well, there is something up with Audrey. I think we can say that at the very least definitively.
Yeah. For those who are hoping that she was on an episode of Invitation to Love or is in a coma or any of these, like, I feel like this week's episode has kind of shattered the idea that what we saw in part 12 was just like a strange contextless scene in terms of like existing in the same, you know, plane and scope of things as we've seen other people in Twin Peaks, because what Audrey says and what Charlie says and the setting of this week's scene all seem to suggest that there's something profoundly not right here. And it's not just like, oh, Audrey's just in her house across town and she's like a little upset and they're talking about characters we don't know. Like, things seem ungrounded to me. Audrey says, I feel like I'm somewhere else. I feel like I'm someone else. And then Charlie gets real fucking ominous.
Yep. He says, do I have to end your story too? Which, like, whose story has he ended already? Is it Billy's? Is that, what does that mean in this context? And then Audrey gets very upset and asks if it's the story of the little girl down the lane, which, as far as I know, isn't something that Audrey has previously voiced as some kind of metaphor for her life. I don't even know. It's very apparent that she's potentially unwell.
Yeah, if we're trying to think of this as still being, you know, tethered to our reality, then it seems like what we're seeing here is either Audrey's unwell or we're seeing a warped perspective on this scene somehow. And it seems like it follows right from what we saw in part 12, only they've suddenly switched like locations. The new set that they're in is similarly decorated in terms of like the era that things come from, and the lighting for the set is similar, but
the like, color palette is very, very similar.
But Charlie's not behind a desk. Audrey is standing like, if we're to understand like how we see the frame, like before Audrey was like where the audience was or where the camera was, sort of, if you were to do a wide, Audrey was on one side of the room and Charlie was on the other, and now they've kind of swapped. And like,
but we're also not getting, correct me if I'm wrong, we're not getting any wide shots where we can see how they're positioned relative to each other. We're not seeing both of them in the same shot at any point.
No, I feel like the Audrey is now standing like in her shots, like more to the left than to the right, which to me implies
No. I fully agree. But I'm just saying, like, we're being presented with this implicit spatial relationship that we can't confirm because we don't see them in the same shot together.
It's fucking weird because sometimes people, I've seen this criticism where sometimes they're like, why are David's, you know, things framed so weird? Why does he work with cinematographers who like odd camera angles and so forth? But then both of these scenes have just been like shot reverse shot shit for most of it, and have been like so static compared to a lot of the, or at least like conventional compared to a lot of what we've seen in the show. And that also disturbs me, because then it's like I'm yearning to see like another shot, another look at the room that they're in, and I don't see it. And so that also feels like a dangling thread, like an unresolved thing in these scenes. But I still don't think Audrey's in a coma. I still think that would be a really lame thing for this to be setting up.
I mean, to be real, I hadn't thought of that, but the fact that she doesn't leave that setting despite voicing her intention to go to the Roadhouse, I think is a huge red flag. That to me is very dream sequence. It's very of the psychology or the experience of dreams, where if you remember when you're dreaming and you're in a place and you aren't populating the rest of that setting, it can be difficult in the context of the dream to leave that setting. Do you know what I'm talking about? Dream logic is what I mean. Yeah.
I do, exactly. But that's like the textbook, and I'm not saying like, here I'm trying to like shatter your interpretation, but like you would say then that's like a conventional textbook interpretation of dream logic, right? Or that's like a common thread. And then when we look at David's other work that deals in dream logic, thinking particularly about Mulholland Drive and even, you know,
Cooper's
Dream in Twin Peaks, this would be so literal compared to that. It would be like Audrey has really boring coma dreams that are just like, here's the little man who's being like, do you want to leave? And you're like, I don't know if I want to wake up.
But at the same time, we just talked about how this scene was kind of like unsettling and made us concerned for Audrey. So I don't think it's overplayed or overly conventional. I think that scenario could still be surprising. It wasn't my first thought. My first thought was that Audrey, or that Charlie, might be emotionally abusive or financially abusive, and that might be what makes it difficult for Audrey to leave. I'm reading Wuthering Heights because I've been reading Wuthering Heights for like 8 months and I still haven't finished it, but this scene and her position in this scene reminded me a lot of Catherine in Wuthering Heights. I don't have a lot to add to it other than that, but it's this feeling of stasis, this being caught between two relationships and at the same time being unable to leave the bad relationship, and the way that both Catherine and Audrey, as these female characters who are kind of passive and acted upon by male characters, voice these kind of emotionally inappropriate, let's say, desires or behave in this kind of bratty way in order to express themselves or manipulate people around them. I don't think that this plot is going to end up mirroring Wuthering Heights, but I think it's an interesting direction to take given the limited scope that they've given her character.
Absolutely. I don't have much to say. I have not read Wuthering Heights. So, I mean, that comparison in terms of like, or that interpretation sounds, it sounds like a sound interpretation to me, and I would rather it be grounded in reality somewhat than for this to turn out to be a dream or sort of other space, because then that just like cracks the door so much wider. And I would rather see this, I would rather see Audrey be able to tie into the main story thread some way. There's something that feels distinctly wrong to me about the notion of Audrey being a side story for having been built up this long. And we know that she's likely, like, practically 100% confirmed as Richard's mother at this point. So if what's up with Audrey turns out to be on the same level as, like, I don't know, hey, is Becky going to get out of her relationship with Steven? Like, that's disappointing to me. Because Audrey was an important part of the show when the show was at its height. And then they put her in One-Eyed Jax for 4 or 5 episodes, and everything was downhill for her character from there. But
yeah. I would love to see her link up with Bobby again. Not in a romantic way. I don't want her to steal Shelley's man. But I do want them to link up. I want them to hang out. That was fun.
It was fun. It was the only fun part of the Ben Civil War storyline. Yep. Seeing those two interact. Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that strikes me about the dialogue in this scene and how otherworldly it is the fact that, first of all, the referencing stories and bringing the idea of a story or a narrative in, and then juxtaposing that within this scene with the idea of personhood, the idea that you are someone else, you can feel like someone else, or this idea of selfhood, that seems to be playing with existentialism, which is what Charlie is saying. This is textbook existentialism. Mm-hmm. These are your fears. But at the same time, to take that and relate it to the idea of story is kind of bringing it to this metatextual level, this understanding, perhaps even this commentary on Audrey is not the person that she was in the original series. This gesture outwards to the metatext of the series. And in relation to the line from the farm, when Renzo, is that the guy, says,
yeah,
so you decide, you stay and play the game, it's your choice. This idea of agency that's become really essential in the Mr. C and Dougie storyline. Literature, and specifically postmodern literature and postmodern works in of themselves, are often spoken of in terms of being playful or being a game, or because they play with the conventions of the form, and they're playing with our understanding of the form. Just in conjunction, it strikes me that this episode, more than any other, is really not more than any other, but is gesturing to the form that we're engaging with, and the fact that this is a text that we're reading and that we're creating. And it's bringing that awareness to the characters, which I find really interesting, especially, like you said, because there's that screen where they're watching Mr. C in the farm.
Yeah.
And kind of drawing our attention to the act of watching.
I mean, if we go back to the first episode with the glass box that the guy was just sitting and watching, yeah, like, this has been something they've touched on at a few points. I guess I'll say briefly that I'd still be disappointed if Audrey was then kind of used just in a, or primarily in a meta gesturing way about the nature of story. But also, Audrey was a character in the original show who was, had like multitudes in that she carried herself a certain way through life and amongst her peers, and then like had visions of like, or a desire to like be with the FBI agent in town and get wrapped up into this greater story. And in some sense, like, she got in trouble because of that, or you could say like her character was punished for that. And so and then we think about Mulholland Drive and how that was originally thought of as like a Audrey pilot, an Audrey spinoff, and how much that is about the stories people tell themselves, like Diane's obsession and this like breeding her other world of like a more ideal situation for her. Like, it would make sense, but right now all I'm getting is these frustrating scenes with Charlie, and it's like,
right. So what would be satisfying in that sense, I think, would be to see Audrey go from being the passive character that she is in The Return to being an active agent like she was in season one, when she had taken it upon herself to kind of investigate Laura's murder and investigate Cooper and insert herself into this world and create her own story.
Exactly. I mean, it's weird because like the thing we dislike, I feel like you and I both dislike most about Audrey in the original show, is the period where she is sidelined and is just, you know, a damsel in distress at One-Eyed Jack's, and that like kills the momentum for her character at that point, after like it builds to this really exciting thing where she's gonna out her dad as the owner and all this stuff. Cool. And here we're starting with Audrey sort of in stasis and struggling against, you know, someone who in a way is like denying her agency, or at the very least like crossing his arms and going like, I'm sleepy, I don't want to go out, if he's a real person. Like, it's same diff. And it's frustrating because I don't want to see Audrey do the exact same thing she was doing before. I just want to see Audrey doing things, and that's not the story they're telling right here. So I'm like just disappointed as a fan in that sense, but I'm game for whatever it is, for whatever game, let's say, they're building here.
Yeah.
I wasn't so game for the next part initially.
Yep. People were weirdly excited about this.
I mean, I was too. I did audibly go, oh my God, when the reveal happened. James Hurley at the Roadhouse playing Just You and I. David and Mark have really fucked us here.
It is the exact same audio from before, and I know that because I cut up that White Sands, New Mexico. Just You and I mashup. So that is literally the exact same audio. He's got two young brunette women crooning, an obvious nod to Donna and Maddie.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
we get
moving
the whole song.
Yep, we get the whole entire song. Fucking song. But it moves a woman named Renee to tears.
Now, have we seen Renee before? I thought Renee was implied to be the same woman he was making eyes across the bar at the end of part two.
I think you are correct. Yes.
Okay. So she was the one who was like, I don't know about this James guy. And then Shelley says, James has always been cool. He was in a motorcycle accident. We still don't know about that. We still don't know about his green gloved friend, who's apparently from England and thinks the Roadhouse is the bollocks. If this is all we get of James, like James's arc is he appears once, someone says he's cool, plays the same song, brings a woman he likes to tears. I'm fucking down, because it's a commentary on James. I don't care if you read this as a defense of James or if you just read this as like a playful finger in the eye of like every fan who's ever complained about James. It fucking rules. I'm sorry. I cringed through the whole song and I couldn't believe they played it. And I think it's still kind of a lame song, but I was so happy this actually happened.
Yeah. I mean,
because they went there.
I fully agree. I was endeared while it was happening, but that song still fucking sucks.
If that had been a scene that everybody loved, that was like universally loved by fans, and then they pulled this, like, oh, it'd be like everyone would be like, oh, this is fan service. Like, this is just the show being like, hey, we're back 25 years later. No, it's there are people who say I've always loved Just You and I, but they're in the minority by and far. The people who are most vocal fucking hate it. I still kind of think it's dumb, but this was a great way to pull it back in.
Yeah.
And you have to do this after you have the Nine Inch Nails, because having the Roadhouse announcer announce and have that pregnant pause was fucking perfect.
It really was. What a moment. But my fear, because I'd forgotten that we had seen Jessica Soar before.
Mm-hmm.
She's a cool lady. She's going to be in the new season of Shameless playing a lesbian. So I might watch that season. I don't know.
That's also a Showtime property, is it not?
That is a Showtime property. She's not a longtime Showtime player. So interesting that that's happening. But I'd forgotten we'd seen her before, and so I was watching the credits, like, what is this woman going to be credited as? And I was so afraid that she was going to be Donna 3.0.
It would be just the fucking thing, though, if, like, we had gotten yet another, like, check-in with Audrey.
Like, 20 years.
And then it's like, here's Donna again. New Donna.
New Donna, younger Donna. But she's not. She's not.
She's her own person, and James has a crush, and she appears to have a crush now. And I'll say she does some real good crying during this scene, and it's like, you can believe that even though the song is what it is, that this person is moved by this song. So good for James, I guess. And hey, props to James's two backup singers who sound exactly like Maddie and Donna. You know, found a real good match there. So silly. I can't. It's just even giving praise to this scene, I'm just like, what am I saying? They did that to us. The show did that to us. Anyway, the other thing this show did to us, which I've kind of belabored the point on, but it's made our friend Big Ed sad by denying his relationship with Norma, which I still contend always a mistake, and by implying that Nadine has her eyes set elsewhere. Ed is left alone in the gas farm to eat his soup and stare at his reflection and get bored and burn some paper, and it looks like business isn't booming. And the weird thing someone pointed out, and there's that word again, weird. Did you happen to check any forums after part 13 aired? Someone zoomed in on Ed's reflection in the mirror, not in the mirror, sorry, in the gas station window. That he's facing when you have that reverse shot over Ed's shoulder. And you can clearly see that Ed's reflection is out of sync with Ed, and then also completely skips back to a starting position. And that is not like one. That's not like when someone looks in the mirror and they see Bob, because then Bob mirrors their actions. That is not like, it's not like anything else we've seen, save for, if you interpret it this way, that cut during the double R diner credits from, I think, part 7, where there's the seeming jump where the patrons of the mm-hmm. double R shuffle around between cuts. And I'll say, given that whole plain window mystery we had several parts back with the flashing and the very clear digital manipulation on those windows that was not there in the original footage, like, if they went in, if that reflection was captured genuinely, which I don't know if they'd be able to do without capturing the camera's reflection. I'm not an expert on these things. But if it was captured genuinely, or if it was placed there after the fact, it's highly unlikely that it would have been a sloppy mistake for them to have another clip they used for Everett doing the same actions from the front and then, like, fucked up. It's very subtle, but it's there, and it's fucking ominous. Because not only are we just watching sad Big Ed alone, but something is wrong in the town. As we've known, when girls start vomiting in the passenger seats of cars and so on and so forth. But this one is spooky as all get out. And that's my spiel on it. Your thoughts?
It is spooky. I just think it's kind of in the tradition of the ominous credit scenes that we've been getting at the Roadhouse, potentially. Although this is certainly more supernatural than the implication that Twin Peaks is overrun by a drug called Sparkle.
Yeah. And this was like, you know, 3 minutes earlier, I was thinking like, oh, we're going to end the episode on fucking Eddie Vedder or something, who's still yet to appear. But no, instead we got James Hurley, and then we got Sad Big Ed, and some spooky effects work is maybe too strong a word, but like weird reflection. And that's the end of part 13, leaving us with only 5 hours of the return left. So let's recap
to wrap up a lot of plots.
So should we start place by place, or break it up to place by place?
I almost, tell me if I'm missing the mark here, I almost feel like we should just go through the IMDb cast list, because I'm afraid we would miss something if we went by location.
I mean, the cast list is pretty long, and there's a lot of people who are involved in the same plot lines. Let's just think through this, and I'm sure the list will be long enough, and if we miss any, people will surely go on Twitter and tweet at Twin Peaks Peaks and say, like, this is also a plot line. But keep in mind, if it's like a throwaway scene, don't bother. Like, if we miss a throwaway thing, don't bother. But let's start with, Jack Rabbit's Palace.
Yeah. Bobby Briggs and Deputy Hawk and Deputy Truman, Sheriff Truman, should all be on their way there.
The Nexus, I'll say, so this all for me is the Briggs Log Lady related investigation in Twin Peaks. That's a thread. And we think it will intersect with the FBI's investigation concerning the coordinates. And we think it will intersect with the doppelganger's reason for wanting those coordinates. So
do you think that the coordinates that Mr. C got from Ray, and maybe this is fully implied and I'm just an idiot, do you think that those are the same coordinates that Diane had?
I would guess so, because I mean, they came from the zone, they were on Ruth Davenport's arm, and then Hastings had coordinates, so yeah. Assuming that Diane has the real coordinates and that Ray provided the real coordinates to the doppelganger, I guess. The doppelganger is going to go to a place called the Dutchman's, presumably to meet Philip Jeffries. That's a thread.
But it also seems like he intends to potentially follow up on the coordinates. So he's got a lot of ground to cover, depending on where the Dutchman's actually is.
Mm-hmm. Richard Horne committed a murder.
Andy Brennan, I hope, is tracking him down.
Andy and Lucy have to get a chair. No. Chad, the dirty cop. Something needs to happen to Chad, the dirty cop.
Yes.
Becky and Steven. Should we be counting these? We're already like past five plot threads. Let's not count. Let's just see how long we can go for. So Becky and Steven, how's their relationship going to work out? Shelley and Red. Red and Sparkle, the town at large. We'll just say, what's the deal with Sparkle? Could Bobby and Shelley get back together? What's going on with Nadine and Dr. Amp? What's Norma going to do about her franchise? Her reputation?
Why is Big Ed's reflection acting independently?
We'll say that, yeah. Or just like, how else is Big Ed going to tie into this? Because I'm still hoping he will be a bookcase boy. What is the significance, or will Carl Rod, having seen the boy's essence after the hit and run, will that tie into the greater mythology in a concrete way?
Yeah. Sarah Palmer.
What's Sarah up to?
If anything. Yeah. Harry Truman. Is he gonna die?
Mm-hmm. Ben, is Ben going to get involved with Beverly
Page. Mm-hmm. Why were we introduced to Beverly Page's husband in the first place?
Is Jerry okay?
I was gonna say. Is Jerry okay? Johnny and Sylvia, we probably won't see them again, but technically a hanging thread.
Mm-hmm. This is a lot just for Twin Peaks, mostly.
I know. I definitely feel like we're missing something in Twin Peaks. I mean, Audrey, like we were saying. What the fuck is going on with her? I don't think we're going to see Snake again.
Should we jump to Buckhorn?
I think we can jump to Buckhorn.
Okay, so Albert and Constance, are they going to be a thing?
Wow, great
Most
question.
Important thread.
Diane, is she evil?
Yes. What is Diane's angle here? I mean,
Will Gordon bed more beautiful women?
Yeah, then I guess the rest of this is just like character development and their investigation that they're involved in at this point. But Diane and her position is a huge thing.
Yeah.
Vegas, what's going to happen to Mr. Todd and the hits that have been called in thus far? What is going to happen to the dirty cops? What is going to happen with Tim Roth and Jennifer Jason Leigh's characters? Hutch
Fusco's,
and Chantal.
Yeah.
What the Fusco's going to go to dinner? Or what?
Anthony Sinclair, are Anthony Sinclair and Bushnell going to continue to figure in?
I mean, I guess this just like then the Dougie thread, like how does the Dougie thread resolve itself? I mean, I guess then the repercussions of that, what's going to happen to Janie E if Cooper regains his sentience?
Yeah.
For lack of a better term off the top of my head. What?
Philip Jeffries.
Yeah. What is up with Philip? I mean,
The
Dutchman's. What's up with the Buenos Aires box? What's up with the New York City glass box?
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck happened to part 8 at all?
Yep. White Sands, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
The Giants, the possibility that Laura is a cosmic plant on Earth, which I still hate.
Yeah, or that Laura has exited the lodge and been sent back, perhaps. Was not, maybe not originally a cosmic plant, but maybe has been. I mean, why did Laura disappear from the lodge? Also, for that matter, still, what's Mike's whole angle here?
Yeah, what is his deal?
What happened to the arm? No, we're not gonna get that.
Chet Desmond's
not getting resolved.
I'm just throwing that out there.
Is Josie still trapped in the wood? Which I feel like is a valid question because of the strange humming at the Great Northern.
I fully agree because of that. Is Catherine still doing yellow face?
Yes, but off screen. We won't see it.
Did Pete get a proper burial? Where is he? I mean, I know he's dead, but like, are we gonna have a moment?
I would be super fucking bummed, actually, if we had a moment where it was like beloved characters standing at Pete's grave. That would be rough.
Maybe when Harry dies, they'll visit his grave.
Oh, Jesus. I don't want to think about that. Okay, but I think that was like well over 20 legitimate plot lines that we've touched on that are like left hanging.
Yeah. Oh, we didn't really break this out, but Mitchum's potentially Silver Mustang Casino, Mandy Candy Sandy.
I feel like they've made good, and I don't think we're going to learn more about Mandy Candy and Sandy at this point.
Potentially not, but I don't anything. They're. Are just so many things that have been introduced.
All right, I'll say this.
That's all I'm trying to establish here.
Jim Belushi and Robert Knepper are both going to catch a bullet for Dougie.
I like that.
They're both going to dive in front of Dougie to defend Dougie.
Okay, but you know what I saw as soon as you said that?
What?
Mandy, Candy, and Sandy are all devastated, and they are sobbing, and they don't even know what to do with themselves.
That would be really sad. But also, this is not a show that's given us many happy endings for characters thus far, save for Dougie's storyline. So, all of our old Twin Peaks faves are going through some stuff. And
everyone's going through some stuff.
I guess as appropriate. Yeah. Yeah. We got 5 episodes left. I'm excited. This was a good episode, I feel like. I'll say that in lieu of a coffee pie log rating. I liked this episode.
Oh yeah, I did too.
But I am just like, as much as I don't want to be, I'm kind of looking at that 5-hour count and going like, hey, what you gonna do, guys?
Yeah, well, especially because there have apparently been no discussions of another season of The Return.
That is unsurprising to me. Utterly unsurprising.
I mean, yes, I fully believe that David was like, here are my 18 hours. I'm not going to leave any cliffhangers to entice the Showtime people to give me another blank check.
If there's any kind of like unresolved threads, it's not going to be so that he's like, all right, let's do this again.
Yeah. Exactly. But at the same time, just the number of things that are unresolved right now definitely would make some sense if this was a different creator, a different showrunner who was setting up some kind of season 2. The Showtime bosses did say at the TCAs that they are open to anything David wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know that that would be another blank check.
I don't know that that would be more Twin Peaks if David wanted to do something at this point.
Right. And that's what they seem to be saying is like, if David wanted to do something else, they're open to it. But that specifically no one had talked about Twin Peaks. And it doesn't seem like that's David's intention.
I saw some rumblings of people going like, Showtime, if you're not going to try to get another season of this, then like, I'm canceling my subscription, or like Twin Peaks, and then I'm out. And it's like, they don't fucking care.
No,
like
they don't give a shit.
They knew this was a potential running into it. They knew there would be drop off, and I'm sure that because it hasn't been a huge success for them outside of the realm of streaming, that they're not really that worried, because they can hang their hat on having made this happen for a long, long time, given how much of a critical success it's been thus far. And they'll still pick up subscribers who don't bother to cancel, or who go like, you know what? Ballers. No, sorry. Ballers is HBO. What's the Billions?
Billions
is a really good show. So Showtime doesn't care. And also, why would you tweet at them 4 weeks before the show's done to be like, fuck you guys? Like, they made your show happen. Just like, chill for a moment.
Yeah. It is interesting though, because that is so anti the Showtime MO to be like, this was only going to be one season and we're leaving it at that, considering the number of times that they have renewed shows long beyond their viability.
I don't know what you're talking about. Ray Donovan season 5 premieres.
Dexter season 7.
And with that joke, I have solely jettisoned any chance I have of ever working at Showtime if they listen to this. I apologize, Showtime. Liev Schreiber is really, really fucking cool. I'm sorry. Don't hate me. Is that it for this week? I don't think there's been any other significant news. There was suggestion. There were rumblings that in Germany they accidentally aired part 14 instead of 13, but I've seen no real confirmation to that effect. So
where did you even hear this rumor?
There were like 3 separate threads. A couple people posted about it on the Twin Peaks Reddit. A couple people posted about it on the Dugpa forums. And then someone was like, look, no one's uploaded it, and I've seen no spoilers leak out or summaries of the episode. So if it did happen, it's so strange to wonder if a thing like that did happen in the internet age. But if it did happen, then hey, props to all the Twin Peaks fans who are keeping their mouths shut about it.
I can't speak. I mean, Variety is reporting that that happened, so it seems like that happened.
But I've seen like nothing, not a peep, and that's been cool. So keep the mystery alive. Yeah. Hashtag blah, blah, blah. Don't talk to us before part 14 airs in America about part 14, please.
You know what? It was uploaded to a streaming service in Germany. It didn't air on linear, so they could have yanked it real quick.
And no one would bother to rip it from the streaming service right away.
Yeah.
Well, unless they're a real dedicated pirate.
Depending just on how fast they were able to do this. Because you just can't yank something from linear and just replace it with something else. But if it's on streaming, you just kill it.
Yep. So. Well, some people might have seen next week's installment early, but I've, again, not a peep thus far. So keep it up. Don't tweet spoilers at us, please. Fuck. If you do that, if you betray our trust, we'll just block everyone who follows us. No, it's not true. And you should follow us. You should follow Twin Peaks Peaks on Twitter. It's at Twin Peaks Peaks. That's where we put up the most stuff. I don't think we need to do returning character polls anymore because we got Audrey and Ed out of the way. So we'll just keep it fun there. And that's where we post about episodes and other stuff we've got going on and retweet good memes like the one I did today about when you realize you have your Google document open in two tabs. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Matthew Olson, M-A-T-H-E-W-O-L-S-O-N. I also do another podcast that hasn't updated in a while called Can You Get to That? Lucky for you, there's like 90 episodes of that sucker. So if you haven't listened yet, there's plenty to listen to. It's about Wikipedia racing. I make it with my friend Caitlin Best. You can find it. It's at Get to That on Twitter. And it's a ton of fun. We'll do another one soon and hopefully get back on a regular schedule. But I had to move and stuff. And that's why the last week's Twin Peaks Peaks was a little late. So you have my personal apologies for that. I couldn't get around to editing it fast enough. And I want to shout out to Cole Hamilton for doing our amazing cover art. You can find Cole on Twitter. He's at CFarEnough. Or you can go to his personal website. It's CollHamilton.com. Thank you, Cole, for the great art. We did see Bobby and Shelley this week, so, and a great shot of the double R diner sign. So really all the elements of our cover art had some quality time this episode. Ashley, your plugs, please.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Ashley Brandt. There's a silent D in my name. I hope you find it. And the K-hole. You've heard me plugging the K-hole before. And we're back to talk about the life of Kylie. It's going to be real boring. BuzzFeed actually stole some of our shtick, which we're going to be talking about. Very excited to delve into that.
And now you're never going to work for BuzzFeed.
Nope. Not after I slap them with this cease and desist.
Okay. Well, this has been Twin Peaks Peaks. Ashley, take it away.
A wrong has been made right, and the sun is shining bright.